morning, everyone. This is MJ Network. MJ stands for my sister, Marcia Joyce, that I created this network in memory of. And I am so pumped and excited because the sun is out. It's beautiful out there. And we're going to talk to Mark Rini, and we're going to talk about a phenomenal novel, Mission Critical. And I am so excited because I love the character of Court Gentry, but actually I like Zoya even better. So good morning, and I'm glad to have you on my show.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I got this book, and I really love it. And Court Gentry, or Vigilante, is now one of my favorite people, so I'm going to have to read everything that he wrote and everything that you wrote about him now. Why was he called the Gray Man? And can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Sure. His moniker is the Gray Man, which is not something he came up with. It's something that, like, intelligence agencies and police departments have started calling him. He is an assassin, but he only sort of takes contracts that he believes are morally valid. And he is, the Gray Man is just kind of a term that's used for somebody that moves or travels in a very low profile. He doesn't stand out. He can sort of slip in and out of situations without being noticed. So that's why he's called the Gray Man. But he's spent, this is book 8, Mission Critical. And so there's a longer story arc. Each one of the books is a standalone, but there's a longer story arc where he's either with the CIA or not with the CIA. And he's at one point in the series, he was wanted by pretty much every intelligence agency in the world and the CIA as well.
Oh, wow. That's scary. So how did he connect with Zoya for the first time? I really like her. She doesn't take any guff from anybody. That's my kind of person.
Yeah, book 6 is called Gunmetal Gray, and that introduced Zoya. At the time, she was working for the SVR, which is Russian Foreign Intelligence, and she was on a mission to capture a Chinese computer hacker who was on the run. And Court was on the same mission for the CIA. And so they were basically at odds with one another. But as things evolved in that story, they realized they had to work together. And Mission Critical opens up with Zoya now in the United States. And she's being groomed to join the same program that Court is in. She's going to work for the U.S.
Well, the first scene is very scary because he's on a plane. And he summons Langley. But how did you create that scene with the blindfolded prisoner? I mean, that was scary. And the fact that he's on the plane and put him in danger, too, in a sense.
Yeah, it just sort of came. I wanted to open it up with, he's on this hunt to discover who this mole in the agency is. But I wanted to make it where this wasn't even really his mission. It was just sort of something that that fell into his lap, and just because of his own morality or his own sort of inability to walk away from what is right, he gets stuck chasing after these guys that just picked up a prisoner. The CIA had taken a guy prisoner, and a group attacks the aircraft to get the prisoner back. So that's just the opening of the story, and it just sets him on this path to go after this mole.
Well, that set me on the path not to put the book down, and you have a lot of pages, and I just sat down and read it. No, seriously.
That's terrific. Yeah, it's a big book,
yes.
I know.
I'm a speed reader, but I read every word. And this one, I said, oh, my God, this is going to do something. So they were transporting someone, and when the prisoner is taken away in a van, why does he follow him instead of just doing what he was supposed to do? He just goes after him, and, of course, that sets off a chain reaction that's unbelievable.
Yeah, he's a character that I've developed. Court, the hero, is a character I've developed over the 8 books, and I say he's sort of chained to his value system, and he ends up doing things he doesn't want to do, but just because he knows he's got to, because it's the right thing to do, he can't turn away. And so this is a situation. Very quickly, he reaches out to his handler in Langley and tells her what's going on. And he's like, I assume we need this guy because a bunch of people just got killed over him. And so I'm gonna keep tailing him until you tell me otherwise. And then he gets more and more involved in this hunt.
I didn't like his humor. I'm sorry. Did not like her at all.
Don't be sorry. She's written that way. That's intentional.
I know. She's evil. I wanted to smack her in the head. She keeps leaving him unprotected and doesn't send anybody to help him. So Zoya is being questioned
she's
over
she's out
there.
To her.
She wants to get him killed, doesn't she? How rude.
Well, without giving too much away, I mean, she definitely has her own set of goals that differ from his. And at certain times, his goals differ from what the CIA wants them to do. So everybody sort of has their own objectives in these in my stories. I think it makes for more tension on the page.
It got me nervous. But, I you know, since he's the main character, I knew you weren't going to get him killed off. But if he killed off the handler, I probably wouldn't have cried. What can I say?
No. It might happen someday.
So he comes. Well, let me know when, because this way I'll help let you. I write my books behind the gravestone, upon the dead person behind the gravestone. That's bad. So let me know. I'll kill her off, too. No problem. But
okay.
When the safe house comes under attack and Zoya, a.k.a. Anthem, escapes, what do they suspect that she might have something to do with this attack? And she's rude. You know, you don't mess with this girl, people.
Well, they suspect she had something to do with the attack because she was a group attacked a safe house and killed a bunch of CIA officers and Zoya gone at the end of it. So they assumed that she was liberated by some force or something like that. Pretty quickly, you realize that there are other factors at play why she had to leave the safe house.
Well, I'm not going to tell anybody why. You know what the cool part is that when I read these books, and I've read so many of them, how is she able to take on different identities and nobody knows that it's her? Real life people would love to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of revealed later in the book how she's grown into that ability, and I tried to make it as realistic as possible because, as you said, she does have the ability to act like an American or act like she's from the UK and totally fool everybody and knows locations and knows details, knows high schools where she says she, you know, went to high school or whatever, even though she's born and bred in Russia and her father was a general in the GRU, which is Russian military intelligence. And her mother was a trainer of spies. You know, it's sort of revealed later in the book how she came into this ability.
I'd love to have the same ability. Let me tell you, that's pretty good. So
yeah.
I think a lot of people would like to be invisible for sometimes. So Vladimir Belyakov, and what is his relationship to Zoya? And she pays him an unexpected visit, and I wouldn't want one of those kind of unexpected visits from her. But that was really interesting, that scene.
Good. Yeah, I did location research in London, and I went on this street where all these, you know, $40 million homes are that look, all you see are gates and fences, and it's, you know, right, it's a couple blocks from Buckingham Palace, and it's very interesting to me, and this character, Vladimir Belyakov, is a Russian billionaire who lives in London, and he was the second in command of her father. When her father was in Russian military intelligence, so she ends up having questions about her father's death, and she knows the one person that would have the answers would be Belyakov. She knows he's living in London as a civilian now, and so she decides to go pay him a visit, and she has to do it very carefully because she doesn't know where his loyalties lie.
She doesn't know where anybody's loyalties are. So who is Fox, and what links him to the banker? And what's his connection to her father? And this poor prisoner, I feel so bad for him, sort of, not really.
Yeah, so Fox is a Russian sleeper agent who has lived in London for a long time and works for a guy named David Mars, who is a British businessman, and the two of them have concocted a scheme that Zoya becomes sort of directly involved in.
Oh, we won't say what, though. So
yeah.
Then we meet the Deputy Director of Operations, Hanley. I don't like him either too much. He seems to have his own agenda too, and then Brewer has her own agenda. How come? Everybody seems to be working in opposite directions, and yet Hanley seems to have something over Brewer. That seems to me that's her problem.
Hanley does have something over Brewer, which he thinks makes her compliant to him. She's not as compliant. The reader understands things that both Court doesn't understand and Matt Hanley suspects but doesn't fully understand. And so, you know, you ask me why, and the reason is that it just creates tension in the story, and tension in the story is why people read these types of thrillers. So if it was a situation where Court loved his handler and his handler loved her boss and everybody was just fighting the good fight together or whatever, it would just be a very different type of story and really not what, what interests me. I like the tension, you know, in the interactions between the characters. Even the bad guys have problems with one another, you know.
Well, I think after reading about 10,000 of these seriously, that's why certain books I'll sit down and read, like yours, and certain ones I'll go, are you seriously telling me that? And yeah.
Yeah.
So then we come to another interesting character. Zhang Mi, Dr. Wan Zhang Mi. What's her real goal for wanting to work in the lab, and what is she really up to? I don't like her either, but she's pretty smart.
So she's a microbiologist and virologist from North Korea, and she's also been trained as an agent for the North Korean government or a spy, and so she's sent into the West to learn information about the biological weapons defenses of the West in general. And as she's doing this, she realizes that her mission, like, she's never going to get the operation that she wants, which is to attack the West with a biological agent that she's come up with. And so she meets David Mars and Roger Fox, and they talk her into joining this scheme that will deal a very crushing blow to the to five of the world's best intelligence agencies.
She's very happy about doing that. It says within 10 days she's required.
She's super motivated.
She's thrilled about it. Yeah, she's totally motivated, so it makes her happy. And how come you decided on a bio warfare as a primary weapon, which is dangerous?
Yeah, I am interested in them. I haven't really used them in books before. So after having written 18 books, you're always looking for something you haven't done before. The way that this weapon would spread, and it would lead to, it wouldn't just attack the people where the weapon was set off. It would attack people down the road, like, you know, people that come in contact with those people who come in contact with those people, and all those people are related. Related in, they're all in the same career, let's say. And so it would be a way to just deal a crushing blow to all these intelligence agencies. Whereas if she just planted a bomb or you know, dropped a missile or something on one location, you would just take out the people there. This way, these people go back to their offices and their military bases and their, you know, departments, and they infect others. That's the idea.
We see that in the news every day, just about. That's scary.
Mm-hmm.
The post office boxes with white powder, or somebody leaves a message in your mailbox and you don't know what it is. You get nervous.
Yeah.
So
doing research on this story, it really opened my eyes to the dangers of certain biological agents.
I know, it's scary. So how did you connect Court and Zoya with her uncle's visit? And she finds out something else that surprises her too, but I'm not going to say what. I just crossed out the end of the question.
How did I connect Court and Zoya? Yeah, so there's a banker in London that is working for the Russian mob, and Vladimir Belyakov, who is the man that Zoya goes to meet. She calls him her uncle. He's not actually biologically her uncle, but she was partially raised by him. Belyakov has connections with this lawyer, And not coincidentally, but, you know, at the same time, Court, who's on a completely different mission, or thinks he is anyhow, is sort of led towards this exact same lawyer. So that both of them are trying to get into this lawyer's office and get information out of a safe kind of at the same time. And that's how they reconnect. Neither of them knew the other was in the same country or that they were involved in any sort of operation. So it's just the first point that where they connect with one another.
Well, we're going to see if they ever stay connected. We don't know. So we have Juan Dangley. This is a really bad character, but you have to like her because she's persistent. And she changes her name. How does she get away with not being who she was? And nobody knows that. That's the scary part.
Well, there's a couple of answers to that. A lot of Asians will use an Americanized name when they're working in the West or working with people from the West. So she changes her name to Janice Wan, or she uses the name Janice Wan, but she's able to get fake credentials from the Russians, even though she's North Korean. She's been working in Russia on their biological warfare stuff. And when the Russians decide they're willing to help David Mars and Roger Fox, they give her all the credentials she needs, and they actually set her up in a job in Sweden, working in the same field. So she's able to sort of procure some of the equipment she needs and whatnot. So that's how that works.
My question, I haven't asked this question yet. It's really weird. So she gets all these fake IDs and stuff, and she goes on a plane, and they can't tell that it's fake. It's so realistic that nobody knows that a driver's license or that a passport or something is forged. They do it so well, and they get away with it. That's what's scary.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, it happens all the time. It's happening somewhere in the world right this very second. There is someone
using
false credentials to get into or out of a country. It gets harder and harder because of fingerprint readers and things of that nature. In my last book, A Mission Critical, I had a character actually use the fingerprints of a murdered person to get into a country, and I did a lot of research on that. And you have a very limited window while those fingerprints are still good, obviously, as tissue decays, and so he had to very very quickly hop on a plane and get where he was going while that tissue was still viable, and he had to put sort of a collagen inside it to keep it moist because the fingerprint readers are looking for fake fingerprints. So, it has to sense moisture, you know, from like a human body.
I know what you're saying. I mean, when I took my test for my reading master's, I'll never forget it, that they fingerprinted you right there. And then they fingerprint you when you go get the license, and then they fingerprint you. But how many times does somebody else take the test for you? You just don't know. I mean, there are people that actually pay people to get fingerprinted for them and whatever. So how does someone like a mole hide in plain sight? How does a mole in the CIA, how do they hide in plain sight and they don't realize that they're there? I mean, is it they're so insimilar? It's scary.
Looking back through history, I mean, it's really depressing. There was a guy named Ames or Andy Ames who was a big spy for the CIA for a long time. And he started out, if I remember correctly, he started out very carefully giving Russians intelligence. And it was just so easy, and no one was looking, and it was so easy that there were literally times where he would just take all the stuff on his desk and just push it into a shopping bag and just walk out at CIA and then take it and either photograph it or dump it off to the Russians. I mean, it was literally, and he got away with it for years because no one believed he was high up enough, and he was sort of part of the old boys network, that nobody really believed that someone like him would do it. And he was actually ended up being caught when they knew they had a mole at CIA because all these guys in Russia were dying, and there was a small group of people that could have been involved, which is kind of how I do it in this book. But they're basically interviewing one guy at CIA for, you know, the fourth or fifth time, and he's very annoyed by getting asked all the time, and he's like, listen, if you want to interview somebody and see who's the mole is, it's like talk to Andy Ames. He's driving a Jaguar and his wife is, you know, like traveling all over the world and blah blah blah. You know, it's like, you know, I know what he makes, and it was as simple as that. And then they're like, okay, well, we hadn't really looked at Ames. We'd interviewed him, but we hadn't really looked at him. But then they started looking at him. It's like, where's this guy got all the, you know, where does all this money come from? So that's what did him in. But I think he spied for close to 20 years or something for the Russians.
And they're probably here right now, and we just don't know it. This is even scarier. I know.
Oh, sure. Russian intelligence actions in the U.S. are at sort of at an all-time high right now.
Isn't that just joyous? I know. And then you listen to some of our lovely people that are in charge speaking on, you want to cry. So tell us about this interesting conference, the Five Eyes Conference. And how are the tables going to be turned? And what is the purpose of this conference? And what is Dr. Wan, what does she want to do as far as this conference is concerned? Because that's where this is going to happen, supposedly.
Right, yeah, that's sort of the third act of the story. The Five Eyes are the five English-speaking intelligence agencies. So it's the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. And so they have an intelligence sharing agreement, and they do actually have meetings at different times in different countries. So in this book, the meeting is in Scotland, and I went to up to Edinburgh and then up in the Scottish Highlands doing research on the book. And you know, their objective is just sort of their annual meeting to talk about sharing stuff and kind of like a get-together thing. And I think I said there were like 400 people there at the meeting, although there's like tens of thousands of people in the intelligence field in these 500, I mean, in these five different countries, the Five Eyes. So Janice Wong and the people that she's working with realize if they are able to infect people at this conference with a biological agent, then those people could go back to their offices and infect others, and that's sort of the plan.
That was a scary scene, by the way, at the end. That's all I'll say about that. Yeah, oh, my God. Yeah. That was like, oh, my God. It sort of makes you not want to go to the doctor or ever get immune or ever go near anybody with germs, ever. It's scary.
Yeah, well, you probably shouldn't. But, yeah, in the case of pneumonic plague, you really don't want to be close to them.
No, as a matter of fact, I often wonder if you go to the doctor's office if that should be wearing a mask so you don't get what they get, they have.
Right.
So Zoya learns about the death of her mother, and how does this set her off on another direction when she finds out the truth about what happened to her?
I don't want to give away too much about
far
deep into the story, but mm-hmm. So she has this sort of mystery about her past, and her mom had passed away and her brother had passed away, and she had been told 14 years earlier that her father had passed away. And so as she starts to unravel things about her own history, it's a very personal story for her. She learns what her mother was doing. I mean, she sort of knew what her mother was doing, sort of working with Russian intelligence as a trainer. But she realizes the way that she'd exposed herself to the British specifically, but the enemies of Russia. And so she learns a lot more about her mom's death as the story goes on.
Well, there's somebody we're going to leave out. I just crossed out another question because I don't want to give away something. So we have another character. I really like him, Zach, and you call him romantic. Poor guy got the worst name in the world. Why? And tell us what he's supposed to. He's really good. I like him. Got to bring him back.
The answer why is because I think it's funny. And like, it's sort of like, and I've heard about this before, like getting, or even like military people getting call signs and code names that they hate. And Zach is a very tough guy, very self-assured. He's in several of the Gray Man books. He first comes in On Target, which is book two, and he has a big role in book five. And he was Court's team leader on a group called the Goon Squad that Court was on. It was like a CIA sort of hit team. And Zach was the boss of that. But now Zach is in the same program that Court is in. It's called Poison Apple, and it's these sort of individual assassins that are doing the work for the CIA, even though they're not CIA employees. And so Zach was assigned a code name, and he's very upset about that because Court Gentry's code name is Violator, which is pretty cool, and Anthem's code name is and Zoya's code name is Anthem, which is pretty cool, and then Zach's code name is Romantic, which he just detests. But they won't, you know, they just keep telling him to grow up when every time he tries to get them to change it, because there is actually a computer that generates code names. And in my story, I haven't decided if it's the luck of the draw or if somebody really is screwing with him and giving him a bad code name.
I think it's really cool because he's cute. It could be called Romantic. The girls will like him.
Yeah.
I mean,
I mean, it's sort of the antithesis of what he wants, because he's considers himself this, you know, tough guy and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny.
So who is Wheeler, and why does Zach relate to Brewer, and that he was up to something and he doesn't believe this Wheeler person? Because Zach's smart. I like him. You have to bring him back again, of course. Can't kill him off. Sorry.
Marty Wheeler works for CIA. I think he's the assistant deputy director of support, and he works for a guy named Lucas Renfro, who is the director of the deputy director of support. So he's kind of the number two guy at CIA in charge of support, whereas Hanley is number two at CIA in charge of operations. And these two guys don't like each other. That's Renfro and Hanley, but Hanley and Wheeler served together in the Green Berets, and they've been friends for a long time. So it's just more political, bureaucratic tension at CIA, like who's the mole and who's the good guy. There's the list of possible moles is derived by looking at who knew what about the operations that were compromised, and the list is down to, I think, four people. And Wheeler's on the list, and Renfro's on the list, and a couple other people are on the list. And so Zach's job is to sort of shake down all these people and see who, you know, runs away scared, because that's the one they figure is the mole.
Well, that's the one they hope is the mole. What can I say? So why is Brewer so against everyone else's thoughts and ideas, and why does she only think that what she says matters? Because she just hears what she wants to hear and doesn't hear what anybody else has to say, which is not good.
Yeah, she's a character that first came along in the book Backblast, and you learn very quickly that Brewer has been an absolute rising star at the CIA, and she's introduced in Backblast as this amazing character, and then as you get deeper into her, you realize that she is just a backstabbing, step on other people's toes and fingernails as she climbs up the ladder type of a person. And Matt Hanley compromises her. He gets some information about her, and Hanley is starting this program called Poison Apple, which is run absolutely off book, and he decides he needs someone to run it on a day-to-day basis who he can trust, and the only way he can trust her is by feeling that he's got something over her that he can use against her. And so he sort of has her number. He knows that she's no good, but he thinks he's manipulating her. And at certain points, he is manipulating her, and at other points, she definitely goes off his script.
She's got to show some gumption. I mean, really, you're not going to let this guy ruin your life, but still, you don't like her. So what happens when
she's
forced into the field and she finds herself needing court? So how does she react to that when the tables are turned? I thought that was fantastic, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've had her in other books, and she's always been the voice on the phone or the person in the conference room talking about what's going to happen. And I thought throwing her into the field, if she's not a field operative, never has been, would be interesting. So I have her go to London for the Five Eyes conference, or the UK. She goes to London first. And while there, she has to get directly involved with the things that are going on. And as you said, later in the story, court is, you know, sort of responsible for, you know, protecting her. And it's just added tension because the reader knows that this lady is not looking out for court's best interest, but court is court. And so he's helping her and that sort of thing. So it's just, you know, the whole idea is to get the reader, you know, against Suzanne and, you know, shouting at court to figure out what's going on.
Well, he sort of has moral ethics and a moral compass. And
yeah, for sure,
he does
for
what's
sure.
right. Whereas you're not sure if anybody else would. I'd be wondering if Zoya would do the same thing in his place. If she would just say, let her rot, because look what happened to me, and look what happened at when the place was attacked. I mean, I wonder if she would say
she
would do the same thing.
So Zoya's only been in two books, and I'm developing her character. Like, I sort of know where she's going to go. But there's mm-hmm. hints in this book that, you know, she doesn't consider herself Lily White or, you know, pure as the driven snow or whatever. And so there's more backstory to Zoya that will come out in later books. She's an interesting character to me, and I like working on her.
This is good because I'll have something to look forward to when you write the next one, which, of course, I'm going to make sure that Lawrence, that he sends it to me even before they put it up on Book Pleasures. And once it's up on Book Pleasures, everybody reads. They read what I write anyway. Everybody reads what I write. And in 5 minutes, I post something on my review site, and I got 10 people saying, oh, my God, I got to get that book. So that's good. And I've been announcing your show, your book for forever and telling everybody that you were number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list. I've been telling everybody. And I have to tell you this,
great.
Like a half a dozen people, the book is next to me. And I could tell you there's a lot of people that are waiting to see who's getting it next. I told them to buy it on Amazon. I think that's a good way to do it.
Well,
I'm
I
a
appreciate
very popular,
that very much.
I'm a very popular person around here. I can't go anywhere
good.
Without people asking me books. So, what other characters would you like to share in the book? Because I don't want to bring out certain people. Are there any other characters you want to add before I ask the next question about the banker?
Yeah, no, there's a character named John Hines who is a basically a bodyguard for the villains in this book. And I sort of created him. You know, you read these thrillers with these heroes who basically can beat anybody up and shoot anybody and never get shot and all this other stuff. And the Gray Man series has never been like that. He's wounded. He's had to, you know, get to the doctors. He's had an opiate addiction because of the pain that he's gone through in books, and things do affect him mentally and physically. And so but he's always sort of won every fight. And I kind of wanted a story where the reader thinks he's going to totally just beat this guy up and be done with him. But it doesn't happen like that. And then they meet each other again and again. And each time Court realizes physically he's met his match in this character Hines. And it was just another aspect of the story to where, you know, Court is not bulletproof and he's not impenetrable and he's not going to, I mean, he sort of at one point, you know, just runs basically. Because I don't want the character to be so, like, you know, superhero. There's enough superhero movies and books and magazines and, you know, comics and stuff like that out there that I want my character to. Obviously, he's got amazing skills and whatnot, but he's a human being, and that was important to me.
Well, if he didn't have flaws and if he, you know, won the fight too fast, it would be fake. You wouldn't believe it. And once in a while, you know, the main character needs to get shot at, whatever, but you don't want him to get killed. That would be bad. So out of all your villains, have you brought any villains back in another book? Because I've asked that questions of other authors. Sometimes the villain is really great, and you want to see if they have to get like Gerard de Moreny's White Widow. He still hasn't gotten really rid of her yet. I'm hoping he does eventually. But do you ever bring anybody back?
I haven't, but I have someone that I have saved. There is a character in Agent in Place, which was my 7th book, and totally intended on him being killed in the last scene of the book up until I was writing that scene. And I was like, I'm going to miss this guy. You know, there's still more for him to do. His name is Sebastian Drexler, and And so he gets wounded, but it becomes pretty evident that he escapes. So it's just another thing for tension for the readers. Anybody that reads the whole series that knows about this knows there's a chance that Drexler might come popping back up at some day. In the third Gray Man book, one of the cartel, he was involved with the Mexican cartels, and the leader of one of the cartels, is on the phone with him at the end, and he said something which they actually say in Mexico a lot, basically saying that you're not going to be alive for long. He said, don't buy any green bananas, because basically you're not going to be around when they ripen. So, when the head of this big Mexican cartel tells Cord not to buy any green bananas, he's saying, it may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, but we're going to find you, we're going to get you. So I like to keep those options open for future plots.
Well, now that I know Lauren, and he loves me because he read my review, I'm going to make sure I get all your books. Seriously.
Good. I have another book coming out in July.
When?
Yeah.
Oh, good. That's even better.
July 16th. Yeah. It's not a Gray Man novel. It's a different novel, but it's coming out this year as well.
That's okay. I read almost everything, but not everything. But before I forget, March is over, and April starts on the 3rd, and I do panel shows a lot. When I brave it, Larry Thompson, Bruce Kaufman, Charles Salzberg, and Jerry Farrell on April 3rd. We're going to talk about setting in a story, but not just where the story takes place, but how the setting drives the plot. What doesn't drive the plot? On April 4th, Ron Francell will be there with his true crime nonfiction, Alice and Gerald. What happens when your wife tells you if you don't kill your stepsons and your ex-wife, she's going to leave you? Find out, because he actually interviewed Gerald, and they still don't know where the bodies are. Scary. On April 8th, Robert Dagoni, the eighth sister. On the 15th, Jewel Grudman, Redfish Oak, really phenomenal historical fiction based on real life about the Plains Indians. And on the 17th, Dylan Volk will talk about his life with Asperger's, which is scary. On the 23rd, John Land, A Strong to Steal. On the 25th, David Burnsworth, Caught Up in It. On the 29th, Rachel and Michael will be here with Trinity House Entertainment .inc and their new inspirational songs. And that's just April. May hasn't even begun yet. Seriously, I get them all. I love it. So let's go back to the banker. I felt so bad for him. That poor man. What did they think he was leaking? And how come he got kidnapped, this poor man, thinking he was innocent?
Yeah, so he managed some accounts in Luxembourg, and one of the accounts was used by the CIA mole, and the CIA has figured this out, and they picked the banker up, hoping he can lead them to the person who owns the account. But the other side, because the people that are using this CIA mole realized that it's possible that the banker could, elucidate the CIA and what's going on. So they decide they've got to get him back and see what he's already told them and whatnot. So when they do that, they attack the airplane while it's on the ground at Turnhill Air Force Base in London. And, the idea is that the banker's got information that could help both sides. And so both sides are fighting to get him.
How did you create the scene with the five eyes? How did you create that whole scene with all those people? That was scary. That final scene.
It's always tough to know how from a million different places, but yeah. I just had this idea about these people, sort of a big group of people being held, and they're all intelligence officials, but their security has been dealt with, so they're kind of helpless. And I wanted the hero and his cohorts to be in the building, but definitely undermanned and definitely with the eight ball against him. And I wanted Zoya to have her own objective at this point, where she isn't necessarily going to do what the Gray Man wants her to do. And so there's a lot of unknowns as that scene or that series of scenes play out.
That was heart-stopping, I'll tell you. I had no idea. I was trying to figure out how you were going to end it, and I'm going like, Oh, my God, because you don't know what's going to finally happen. And she had a specific goal, which we won't say at all, which which is, this, you know, explains the end of the book, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So he places himself in danger, and yet Bruin needs him, but she's so unempathetic to him. Why? I mean, seriously, I think she's just jealous because he's better than her.
Well, yeah, it just goes back to that she has different objectives than she does, and than he does, and so they want two different things. She does not want to work in the Poison Apple program anymore because it's a secret program that she thinks is going to blow up in her face and ruin her career, and she doesn't want to work for Hanley anymore because Hanley is impeding her, you know, meteoric ascent at CIA. And so these reasons, while for a normal person, these reasons wouldn't be enough to, like, kill people or, you know, watch people die. In Suzanne Brewer's world, that's all she needs to motivate her.
That's always nice. She's such a wonderful person, and I take it you're not done with her yet either. Mm-hmm. So
No, she'll be back.
That's good, because you can hate her a little bit more. So I like Zoya. And I think she's very resourceful. But what about, you know, all people are going to ask this question, what about her relationship with Cord? Is it going to go anywhere, ever? Or is she going to be on her own?
That's to be determined. I can't say for sure. I like the fact they're not going to be in every, she's not going to be in every book. The book I'm writing now, The Gray Man 9, is called 1 Minute Out, and it's very much Court on his own. Zach's not in it. Hightower's not in it. Brewer's not in it. He's doing his own thing. But the book after that will probably have Zoya and Zach and that whole gang in it as well. So their relationship, it, like a lot of relationships, is going to be and stay complicated, but it will definitely be, you know, it'll definitely change, you know, throughout time.
Well, see, that brings me to my fact that she's a very strong female character. So those people that don't know, on June 19th, the one and only Philip Margolin, R.G. Belsky, David Burnsworth and Alan Topol were going to do a panel show with me on strong female characters, because I thought that would be a cool way to end my last show until they asked me to do one more. Yeah, I love doing panels because it's fun. I love to get the different perspective of people. So what is the reason why they Zach and Zoya and Court are part of the Poison Apple program? And is Zach going to remain on this team? Are they going to keep the three of them?
I won't say what's going to happen in future books, but they definitely they're on Poison Apple because they're all three sort of deniable CIA assets. They don't work for the CIA. Court and Zach did formerly work for the CIA, but people know that the CIA has been after Court for years, so they see him as like someone they can use, and no one's going to track it back to the CIA. Zach has basically just fallen off the radar, so they can sort of use him because he's not he's not known like the Gray Man is. And then Zoya is a former Russian spy who's been flipped by the CIA, and they see the potential in her of bringing her into this program as well. So they, all three of them, and there might be more Poison Apple assets in the future, and it's a program that, you know, can go a lot of different directions.
I was going to ask that question, but will they ever catch Court? Are they ever going to get him from the CIA? Is there ever going to be a plot where he has to really get out, ever?
He works for them when he wants to. He kind of has an agreement with them that he'll work with them, but he retains the authority to pick up his own sort of solo missions if he feels that they are they're worthy. So that's where the series is at this point. And as I said, in book 9, he's doing his own thing, you know. So he's found an operation that he feels is righteous, and the book opens up with him on this mission that has nothing to do with CIA, and then that gets complicated, and that takes him to many different countries and back to the United States and whatnot.
Well, if God forbid this plot succeeded and this bio warfare, you know, came out, how would that be contained, and how would people how would it be stopped and people would die? What would happen? What would the CDC do in order to not make it worse, make it a pandemic?
The pneumonic plague is more dangerous than bubonic plague, because with bubonic plague, you have sort of a better window for antibiotics or whatever. Pneumonic plague, there's a certain amount of time you don't know you have it, and then pretty shortly after you know you've got something, antibiotics won't cure it anymore. And in this story, I actually have the North Korean scientists work on a strain of the agent to change that timeline a little bit, just to make it fit the story a little bit better, make it sort of fatal quicker. In the real world, if this was used, just as in the book, it would, you know, affect 100% of the people at the beginning, and then those people would go off for a few days back to wherever they come from, and it would probably affect 50 people, you know, 50%, and then they would then there'd be the third order effects. And pretty soon they would realize that there was a biological agent out there, and anybody who was sort of in contact with somebody who's sick or has died would start getting massive doses of antibiotics. So it would stop. And I mean, it wouldn't grow across the world or anything like that. But the objective in this book is a certain, you know, a group of people that work in the intelligence community, and that would be pretty much devastated if something like this actually happened.
It's scary, because I'm sure there are countries in the world that would like it to really happen if they could get away with
sure,
it.
Sure, of course.
That's what's, that's what's really scary. I mean, even when they have these new vaccines for different diseases, there's more side effects for some of these medications than there are than it pays to take them, you wonder sometimes, too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is going to be, and there's no cure for anything. Then there's no cures for anything. There's just like a little Band-Aid. So, at the end of the book, without saying why does Soya snap, and where is she going to go from here? Because she realizes something, and she's not a happy person.
Yeah, she at the end of the book, she's not satisfied with how things transpired, and she does talk to court. It's not that she just completely, you know, runs off on her own, but at the same time, you understand that there's some new tension between the two of them because of some things that happened in this story. And he definitely wants her in his life, and she is not as sure because of some things that have happened. So she goes off her way, he goes off his. She's on her way back to the United States, and that's all we know.
And what about court? Where's he going next?
I'm going to do some research in Bosnia and Croatia and Italy and in the U.S. and in Los Angeles, which are all these sites taking place in the next book.
Oh, wow. That's going to be interesting. Andrea Kane's Dead in a Week.
Yeah.
It takes place in Croatia. She has some contacts over there that actually helped her in law enforcement. Because when I sat and read the book, I said, you know certain things that you read, but when the author actually goes there and learns about it, it makes it more credible. And I have to tell you, I'm terrible because when somebody writes something like that, Fran looks up the stuff to make sure it's real. I do. I do my research too, which is great.
I do that just sometimes just out of curiosity. I want to look and know a little bit more about what people are talking about. Yeah.
Well, let's choose. Why did you choose those settings for the next book?
It's sort of plot-driven. The next book opens up with him after a guy who is a Bosnian war criminal, and then that just turns out to be the opening scene of the book, and this, that's not what the story's about, but while he's over there, he uncovers some information. So I wanted to set it over there. Be perfectly honest, I love scuba diving, and I want to go to Croatia and do some scuba diving, and I'll work that into the book. and then Italy makes sense for the kind of the plot line of the story, and same with L.A. L.A. is where it all takes place. Yeah.
Well, what I did appreciate, people, is the fact that not everybody does this. When you have a lot of characters and you want to make sure that everybody understands who they are, the fact that you had the character list, not that I'm not going to know who everybody is, because I do, it just sort of made it better and easier for me to spell their name right. and for know who they are.
That's good for reviewers. That's a good point. I never thought of that. But no, it actually helps. Yeah. Readers tell me all the time they like, because not everybody reads a book in two or three days where you can sort of keep it all together. Sometimes you put the book down for a while, and I'm a reader too, and so I know how it is, and so it's nice to be like, okay, I remember this guy, but what is his title? What does he do at CAA? And you can go back and look at it. I started doing it with the Clancy books because there were so many characters. And frankly, I used it for myself. I would go back and look at it. I'd write the characters down as I got to them in the story. And then I'd be like, all right, what's this guy's name again? And I'd go back and look at it. Or what's this guy's title? Because they're such big books and so many characters.
I know the Clancy books have a lot of characters, and I wish everybody would do the same thing. But then sometimes there are too many characters, and it gets like, oh, my God, how many more people do I have to know? And I'm one of those people that reads a book, and if a book takes me seriously more than 2 days to read, you're in trouble. Then I know that I'm not going to finish it. I finish everything. Mm-hmm. But then if it takes me like a week or two, then you're in trouble. Because it means that, oh, my God, I lost interest. But not with this one.
Right, right.
I'm not, they're like, but there were like so many different characters. And like I said, because you want to put the words in, you want to put the character's name in a review, but you don't want to put everybody's name, but you don't want to spell the character's name wrong. And you're not going to go through the whole book to find it. So, which characters are you going to, besides Court, which characters are you going to bring back in the next book? We have about 5 minutes. If anybody.
Off the top of my head, not a single character from this book will be in the next book. It's a very much a different story with different characters. As I said before, they will come back. I just did a three-book deal, so there's at least three more Gray Man books coming, so I can go in different directions with different ones. But the next one is a very much a standalone story where you're kind of looking over Court's shoulder as he moves through this operation that he's in.
Well, what's coming out in July, you said before? Which book is coming out in July?
Yeah, it's called Red Metal, and it's a big military thriller I co-authored with an active-duty Marine Lieutenant Colonel. And and I are friends, and we've been working on this book for years and years. And together we went to Poland and Germany, and he went to France, and we went out to Nellis Air Force Base to do some research, and he got on board a Virginia-class submarine. And it's a big story about a Russian invasion of Europe that takes place at Christmas. And it's not all military characters in the story. There's a lot of civilian characters in the story as well. But it's a big book, and we've literally been writing it for 3 years and working on it for six. And it will finally come out in July, so I'm pretty happy about that.
And you're going to use Lauren is going to be the one that's going to be your publicist on this too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Now I know who to contact. Okay, I'll just tell everybody before we close. This is exciting, let me tell you. And the next time you decide to write something, well, you're not going to write Clancy anymore. Mark Cameron is taking that over. And I know there's another one coming out very soon, from what I gathered. So where can we learn more about you and your work and your other series? So everybody will know that. I also put your links on my Facebook wall because everybody reads that, and everybody's been reading it, seriously, by, as I'm doing this.
Good. Well, it's a my website is my name, Mark Graney, Graeney books.com, and it has information about all my books and audiobooks and about about Red Metal, the book coming out in July. And I also have a newsletter you can sign up for that only goes out once a month. It sort of tells people where I'm working on and what I'm working on and the status of the stories and whatnot. So I hope they'll sign up for the newsletter as well.
I hope so, too. I just posted the link for the show on my Facebook wall. I'm going to send it to Lauren so he could send it to you. I want to thank you so very much. This has been fantastic.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Your book, Mission Critical, is great, and I hope I get to do this again. Do you attend the Thriller Fest by any chance?
At the Grand Hyatt? Yeah, I'll be at Thriller Fest this year. I don't go every year, but I'll be there this year for sure.
I'm going to get to say hi because I get invited every year.
Good. Very good.
I'm their resident favorite book reviewer and talk show host, and John Land loves me, so what can I say? And Kimberly Howe is the best. So thank you so very much, everybody. It's a beautiful day. Have a great day, and thank you, Mark, and bye.
Thanks so much.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge for a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there.